And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast. We are recording this on Thursday, right after the buzzer of the same game that the Lakers and the Nuggets always play. At this point, Lakers fans have to feel like Krusty the Clown when he bet on the Washington Generals to beat the Harlem Globetrotters. It's not going to happen. The Denver Nuggets with another second half rampage. Their style of rampage is slow motion, inevitable, just avalanche of slow Jokic baskets and Murray baskets and Michael Porter Jr. baskets and Aaron Gordon being everywhere, ushering the Lakers into an offseason of great uncertainty almost across the board, with LeBron James having a player option, D'Angelo Russell. Oh my God. 0 points on zero of everything, zero for life in game three. Has had two horrible games in this series and one good one. Almost feels as if he's canceling out a good season in 1 week. Darvin Ham, all of it will be reevaluated once this series is inevitably over. The Orlando Magic roared back to life at home, beating the Cleveland Cavaliers, who decided, hey, we've proven so much in the playoffs, we don't have to show up for this game. Hey, we're the Cleveland Cavaliers. All we did is get humiliated in the first round last year, tank into this matchup in embarrassing fashion, give the Orlando Magic bulletin board material, blow the doors off the Magic in two games because they couldn't shoot straight. We don't got us? The Cleveland Cavaliers? We don't have to show up. But the headliner, as we welcome in Mo Dekeel from The Athletic, from Bleacher Report, former video coordinator for the Los Angeles Clippers and the San Antonio Spurs. The headliner in a little bit of a spicy game. The Philadelphia 76ers, fresh off the heartbreak at Madison Square Garden, the great last 2 minute report scandal of 2024, the incredible, just ridiculous comeback from the Knicks, rebound in Philly behind Joel Embiid, who, Mo, I called on NBA Today yesterday the great tragic hero of the NBA. Did not know that he also was suffering from Bell's palsy, which Woj broke tonight, which explains why he was wearing sunglasses and all that stuff. And sure, just pile that atop the Joel Embiid postseason malady list that just seems to grow longer and longer. 50 points on 19 field goal attempts for Joel Embiid, as the Sixers, behind a majestic performance from a guy who still does, frankly, he got a little bouncy late in the game, and we can talk about that, but still doesn't look like himself, particularly on the glass and on defense. 55-0 points to beat the Knicks at home by 9, I think, and get back in that series. Let's start there. What did you think of Embiid? What did you see from the Sixers that matters going forward into, it's not a must-win game four, but if they lose game four without home court advantage, they're in big, big doo-doo.
Yeah, I think the first thing is kind of, I think it just shows Embiid was right after game two. And I think that's one of those things, like when we talk about like the a lot of the adjustments, there wasn't a lot of adjustments, I think, for the Sixers. They're at the end, they're in both of those games and should have won game two with the way it went. And I think the fact was they just came out with a much more focus, much more interest, like locked in attack early on, pounding the post with Embiid and letting him go from there. I thought Maxey was actually pretty rough in the first half, but he got going in the second half and really found his rhythm. But I just think it just proved that, hey, Embiid's going to get you in foul trouble, and then the Knicks don't have an answer for that. Once Hartenstein picks up a few fouls, then you have Mitchell Robinson pick up a couple of fouls in the first half. You're in trouble at that point, and I think Embiid just feasted off of them after that.
Well, you know who else had foul issues? Joel Embiid, who picked up three fouls in the first half. The last one was a charging call in which he looked a little bit lurchy and charged into Mitchell Robinson. We should also mention that Mitchell Robinson left the game with a sprained ankle, and there was video of him leaving the arena in a walking boot. That's a big deal potentially going forward for the Knicks. But Joel Embiid stayed in the game with three fouls in the first half, did not commit a fourth foul in the first half, and proceeded to just dominate the game. I thought you just nailed it with well, actually, you know what? Let's start with the spice. Joel Embiid was called for a flagrant one for wrapping up Mitchell Robinson's legs as Mitchell Robinson went up for a putback dunk. I wouldn't call it a tackle. I would call it something you would do in football if you were in the position that Joel Embiid were in football, prone on your back without much else to do. Also appeared to hit a knee Isaiah Hartenstein in the groin as they kind of just decided to have a collision. They look like hockey, like hockey goons. It's like, you know what? It's time for us to just collide and see whose body part hits whose body part and who gets hurt. Did not get called for a flagrant on that. Obviously, Knicks fans, fresh off their own officiating, aid in game two, are a little, Tom Thibodeau had some comments after the game. Which flagrant foul? Which one are you talking about? They're a little miffed about Embiid maybe not getting tossed from this game. I personally was fine with him not getting tossed. They clearly have built in the flagrant criteria, unnecessary and excessive, allows them to legislate around the outcome of an act, and Mitchell Robinson kind of fell softly. Should also mention Joel Embiid did a softer version of the Draymond Green leg kick into the groin of, was that Hartenstein again?
Yes.
Poor guy. My God. That's what you get for hitting 8 floaters every game that barely even touch the rim, Isaiah Hartenstein. What an outstanding... By the way, Knicks better bring that dude back next year. That guy is good, and he's earned a lot of money. I was fine with the decision to let Embiid stay in the game. I didn't think it was that big of a deal, but maybe I'm just delirious from watching all these games.
I think I was fine either way. It was a real judgment call. Like, if they actually gave him a flagrant two for the Mitchell Robinson one of the injury, like, I would have been okay with that too, because that's just a crazy dangerous play in that instance when you're trying to grab his legs. And I think, you know, again, Mitchell Robinson leaving with a walking boot, not exactly an encouraging sign in that regard. But, like, if they had called it a flagrant two, Zach, I mean, like, we all would have gone nuts. I still would have thought, like, okay, that's actually pretty fair. Them deciding, hey, it's a flagrant one, we're going to keep it moving, I'm fine with that too. Like, it was that close to me. It could have gone either way.
It's clearly a dangerous play, which is why I mentioned that they can kind of legislate based on the outcome of the play more than anything else. It is a dangerous play. I mean, if that's an airborne high velocity kind of play, that's a flagrant too. Let's talk about what we saw that might carry over into game four. You mentioned that Maxey got going in the second half, and one of the reasons he got going was he finally got a rhythm with Joel in the pick and roll. And one of the ways he did that was by bringing Jalen Brunson into the play. They ran that same play over and over again, a staggered pick and roll with Kyle Lowry setting the first screen and Embiid setting the second one, because Brunson was on Kyle Lowry and they wanted Brunson to switch on to Maxey. There was at least one play where Maxey just ISO'd him and hit a three right over Jalen Brunson. I actually think both teams could aim their star guards at the opposing star guard a little bit more and just let them cook. But they got in a rhythm on that. Joel Embiid started hitting pick and pop threes. And then if you remember, the Knicks started overcorrecting to that and sending help flashing toward him, a third defender flashing to Joel on the pop. And Kyle Lowry got a wide open corner three out of that. Kelly Oubre cut baseline for a basket out of that. I would expect to see a lot more of that in game four. I also thought Brunson he had 39 points or whatever. He got into a rhythm, but specifically he got into a rhythm in the third quarter going at Embiid's pick and roll defense. Like, you're going to sit back there, big fella. You don't want to move. I'm going at you. And if that screen hits, or better yet, if I get Maxey on me first and then that screen hits Maxey and I got airspace, I'm going to go at, sometimes I might try and go around you, but I'm at least going to go at you and hit jump shots. And then you could see the evolution of it. Embiid blitzed once instead of dropping back, and Hartenstein just rolled and got an easy dunk. Then they took Embiid and they put him on Josh Hart and said, we just want him out of the pick and roll altogether. Then they played zone, and the zone in this series has made me nervous because it feels like it is solely designed to protect Joel Embiid from having to move around the floor. But it was good for the Knicks, I think, to see Brunson get going. This was a well-played offensive game by both teams, I thought.
Yeah, I thought actually the offense on both ends was pretty solid. They both kind of knew where they wanted to attack. It was, you know, you just kind of outlined perfectly how Brunson attacked the pick and roll and went at Embiid and basically forced the Sixers into different coverages to try to protect Joel Embiid and all that. I think we're going to see all of that again in game four. I think the stuff that I think we could see a little bit better from the Knicks is, like, cool, when they put him on Josh Hart, bring him into the screen. Like, I just think we're just don't let Embiid rest for the most part with everything that they're doing in that sense, and allow him to keep attacking. I would think, though, at some point the Sixers are just going to sell out and just try to get the ball out of Brunson's hands once he starts cooking, because that's, to me, the biggest weakness with this Knicks team with Randall out. Like, who do you trust to play make after Brunson? Who's the secondary guy that you're just so confident is going to get you create a bucket for everybody else? And I think that's the thing that's missing with this Knicks team. I think that's part of where they're missing Julius Randle and the large portion of it. And I think that's coming. They haven't really done it yet, but I think the Sixers are just waiting for one Brunson really gets going and they're in a situation where they're in a little bit of trouble. I think we're going to start to see that. And I don't know how the Knicks counter that.
And then they just kind of do it by committee, like Josh Hart, random fast breaks. DiVincenzo has actually upped his pick and roll volume a little bit in this series and gotten good stuff out of it. Anunoby had probably his most self-creation of the series in this game and looked okay doing it. Bogdanovich would help. Tibbs just doesn't seem to trust him to play more than 12 to 18 minutes a game. And the Sixers are hunting him on defense every time that he's in the game, every single possession. I was encouraged, you know, it was a jump shooting game for Embiid. You did not see a lot of the power post-ups after the first quarter, which is fine. Like, obviously, he scored 50 points. Like, he can score. He could do anything. But I was encouraged at the end of the game in the last 5 minutes, he had, like, a crazy acrobatic closeout on a Josh Hart left corner three where he went all out and leaped as high as he could into the air and clapped his hands above his head. And I was like, oh, okay. And then right after that, he got the ball at the top of the key, I think against Precious Achiuwa. I may be misremembering that. And just was like, I'm going right at you, full blast, all the power I can summon, and drew a foul. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, he's not totally compromised. He can summon that kind of physicality late in the game. I do think his defense is something to watch going forward. I liked that lineup when they replace Tobias Harris with Batum. I think that might be their best lineup so far in this series, although Tobias Harris was okay in spurts tonight. And I don't know, what else from this game? What else stuck out to you? I'm scanning my notes to see if there's anything else that needs to be said other than just a masterpiece from Joe. I mean, and like, he's injured. He's clearly not 100%, and he's gutting this out. He has Bell's palsy.
Like, it's just, let's just throw more. You know what I mean? What else can we add to the list in terms of what Embiid's going to have to go through with that? But I think the other thing that's kind of encouraging with those late moves.
Is he on the Oregon Trail? Is he going to get snake bite?
There's the snake bite. There's a watch out for dysentery. Like, there's a whole lot of stuff there on that Oregon Trail. But the thing with Embiid, more impressive, is that, like, I think he's actually getting his legs under him too. And I think getting a little bit more stamina, which kind of explains some of those bursts that we're seeing at the end of games. Because I think that was the stuff, especially in game one, I felt like he just had no legs, you know, when it came to the end of that game. And I feel like he's slowly getting that back. You can tell he's not 100% because the defense. But on offense, you can tell it's legs and stamina is the biggest concern for me in that end. And I think that's kind of the difference with the two. We'll know when he's getting healthier because he'll get more aggressive defensively. Offensively, we know when he's feeling more, he's got more juice and more stamina, then he's going to be able to push. And I think those are the things to kind of watch for. But I also think the Knicks got to figure out how they're going to handle that two-man game with Maxey. That's going to be the big thing for them that is going to keep Tibbs and that coaching staff up all night. This is what happens after the game as a video guy, like on the road. Cool. Sometimes we're watching that game as a staff that night. We're pulling clips. We're getting the list of clips of like, okay, this is for the team edit. This one we're going to show to, the bigs. This one we're going to show to the guards. This one's just for Brunson. This one's just for whoever. We're pulling all of these clips out. And then you're looking at each other going like, how do we attack? How are we going to handle these things? And I don't think they have a great answer for the Maxey and B two-man game, because they just do a good job playing off of each other. Maxey does a good job of really stretching that out and pulling Isaiah Hartenstein with him. And then it opens up the pop to Embiid. And like you said, they bring the third guy off, and Embiid's going to find the guy. He's going to make the next pass. There's going to be just so many different things that they got to figure out how to just handle that. That's the beginning for the Knicks coming into game four, is what do you do there?
And it's interesting because the Knicks are not a, a big team of defensive tinkerers. Like, they kind of just play how they play. They don't bust out, like, all of a sudden they're blitzing Isaiah Hartenstein. Right. And they just kind of, like, OG Anunoby is going to fight over the screen. Hartenstein and Mitchell Robinson, if he can play, or Chua, if he has to play, are going to come up, you know, probably to the level and not much higher than that. Chua can switch. And the Knicks have flirted on a few possessions here or there with switching Anunoby onto Embiid. Anunoby's a big, strong dude who's guarded a lot of centers, particularly under Nick Nurse, ironically, in Toronto. Joel Embiid's a different animal. And I think that's worth, like, mixing in, particularly if you can have the help ready behind it. Like, you know you're going to do it every once in a while. You have the help ready behind it. I think that's interesting, particularly with Achua. But Maxey is so fast. Like, he's not a typical point guard, even for a switchy big guy. Like, Achua is a pretty good switcher. Like, Tyrese Maxey is a turbocharged water bug out there. He can blow by anybody.
I mean, there was one play where he did exactly that against Achua. Like, it's easier said than done. So I know when I say it, it sounds like it's so simple. But there was a play where he comes off, I think it was a handoff off of Embiid, and he turns the corner and Achua switches, except Achua doesn't stay parallel to the sideline, right? Like, he almost opens the door and is trying to meet Maxey at the basket. And good luck with that, because you're already beat at that point. Once you kind of open it up and you're at a 45 angle and not just kind of squared, Maxey's going to beat you to the rim every time. And the time he doesn't, it's because he decided to slow down, not because you caught him. And I think that's the big thing there with Maxey. That's the problem with the speed with Maxey that I think is going to be a real issue for them. And again, it comes down to that two-man game.
Well, hopefully we get more complaints to the league office now from the Knicks side. Compiling a fat dossier of complaints.
Does Leon Rose send the grievance now, or are we going to send a grievance for this one? Or
I think Daryl Morey is still filing grievances over the 2018 conference finals against the Warriors. I think that audit is still ongoing. A crack staff of like 50 people are still digging into that to just maybe the Rockets are going to be retroactively rewarded the NBA championship. I picked the Knicks in seven in this. Did you make picks before the
I had the Knicks in seven.
I was a little worried when it felt like the tide was turning at the end of the first half of this game that it was going to be like, here come the Nova Knicks in Philly, you know, a lot of Knicks fans in the stands. They're the healthier. Well, I mean, Randall's hurt, but, you know, they're not dealing with quite as much as the Sixers. You know, and the other, I mean, the Sixers are getting absolutely nothing from Buddy Hield. I think he played 4 minutes in this game. We should mention Campaign came in and became Buddy Hield, essentially, and just rained threes randomly after not playing much.
All right.
I do think it's worth revisiting that the Sixers traded James Harden, discovered, much to their delight, that Tyrese Maxey was a legitimate co-star for Joel Embiid, acquired a bunch of draft equity in exchange for James Harden, talked a lot about how they were going to use that draft equity to upgrade their team, maybe at this trade deadline, maybe in the offseason when they have a bundle of cap space, max level cap space. Paul George still has not signed an extension with the Clippers. That's neither here nor there. I would expect him to, but until he hasn't. And they didn't really do anything at the trade deadline to upgrade their team. I mean, Buddy Hield was a worthy shot with a bunch of second round picks. He's not doing anything for them in this series. And I think that's a frozen moment. It's not like any big, big names were acquired at the trade deadline. In fact, the Knicks got a lot of positive press, including from me, for acquiring Bojan Bogdanović and Alec Burks. Alec Burks has not played in weeks, and Bojan Bogdanović is not playing very much. So it's not as if there was some big, giant prize out there for them to get. But they were also, I think, a little bit frozen in place with the uncertainty of when is Joel Embiid actually going to come back? In what condition is he going to come back? It's hard to make a big bet without knowing that, but they're kind of paying the price a little bit for that in this series. No D'Anthony Melton tonight, although he was active, he did not play. Anything else from this game before we move on? Great win for the Sixers. Obviously, like, Embiid's had other incredible playoff games, you know, the airplane game against Toronto that gets replayed over and over again. Probably the best playoff game of his career and the most consequential game of his career. And the fact that he's doing this all with an injury, like, you just can't say enough about. I mean, I'm alternatively like awed by what he's doing and just worried that, you know, every game that he leaves to go to the locker room, I'm like, oh my God, is this going to be the one? And it hasn't been yet. And I think, you know, Doris Burke talked about how he's just sort of mentally dealing with recovering from injury. And every time he lands a little funny, you know, that's it. That's an issue. But anything else from this game?
No, I think you nailed it, calling him kind of like the tragic figure, tragic Shakespearean figure in the NBA with Embiid. But it's awesome to see, and I'm glad we actually got a fun one out of this one here, and we're ready to roll. I'd have been pretty disappointed if the Sixers went down 3-0. I think we're getting lined up for hopefully a fun series.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because of the eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Shopping for Mother's Day is usually a challenge because you wait until the last minute. Shame on you, by the way. But Macy's Gift Finder makes it incredibly fast and easy to find the right gift just in time for Mother's Day. Whether you're shopping for your sister's first Mother's Day or your fashionista mom who loves to make a statement, Macy's Gift Finder has so many great gift ideas, you can easily pick out something special to celebrate them both. You can shop by price anywhere from $25 and under to $100 and under. You can also sort by category like fragrance, handbags, more, or gift lists like for the mom who has everything, pre-wrapped gifts, gifts for grandma. You can find top brands like Studio Pro Model Beats headphones, Polaroid cameras, and Samsung Smart TV. So what are you waiting for? Mother's Day is May 12th. That's very soon. It'll be here before you know it. Macy's has the perfect gift guide to make picking something for your mom easy this year. Head to Macy's.com/giftfinder today. That's Macy's.com/giftfinder. A team that did go down 3-0 is the Lakers. we were going to have on NBA today a one of those, you know, debate segments where the question was, what's the more likely outcome in the series, a Denver sweep or a 7-game series? And we were all like, seven? Right. The Lakers haven't beaten this team in 2 years, like literally 2 years. They're going to beat them 3 times now. And, you know, obviously game two was just an all-time gut punch, heartbreaking loss for a team that has absolutely no margin for bad luck, for injury, for underperformance, for anything in this series. They had to have that game. They didn't get it. They come out like a house of fire in this game, go up 8-0, timeout. They're up at halftime. And never for 1 second did I sit here watching the game thinking, oh, they're going to win the game. In fact, I thought, well, let me set my watch for when the Nuggets are going to be up by 7 in the third quarter. And just like that, the Nuggets were up by 7, 10, 12. Lakers would make a couple random baskets. They just don't have any answers, enough answers anyway for this team. And like I said to open, like they're not going to win this series. Maybe they squeak out game 4 and force Denver to go back to Denver and close it out, but they're not going to win the series. And they're going to go into the summer with D'Angelo Russell with the player option, LeBron James with the player option, Darvin Ham on the hop seat, 3 first-round picks to potentially trade, both point guards in Atlanta potentially available, among other targets. One way or another, this team is going to look different next year once this series is over. They've played well. They've played honorably. They've been a very good team for 2 months now, 28-14 to close the season. If they had won a few more games in the regular season, they might be going toe-to-toe with the Clippers, the Mavericks, a team that's still really good but isn't the Nuggets. I don't know what's worth talking about from this game. I mean, it's the same game every time. It's the same game. It's I'm watching the game and I'm like, am I really watching this again?
Yeah, I mean, we saw this almost exact game in game one. It was the third quarter in game one where the Lakers scored 18 points, the Nuggets got 32. Tonight it's a 34-22. You know, Nuggets win the third quarter. Game two, it was the fourth quarter where the Lakers fall apart. They only get 20 points in that quarter and the Nuggets get 32. Like it's one quarter. That's all the Nuggets need in every game in this series against the Lakers. And even going back to last season, one quarter is all it takes for them to kind of run over the Lakers and go through it. But the guy has probably been the most unsung hero in tonight's game for the Nuggets.
I can't wait. I know who you're going to say. I can't wait. Please say it.
It's Aaron Gordon.
Aaron Gordon.
Phenomenal. And he kept this game close in the first half. Like, honestly, this could have been a big lead for the Lakers, but it was Aaron Gordon just crushing the Lakers on the offensive boards, was all over the place running the lane, was everywhere defensively. You put a small on him, cool, he posted up. Like, he was everywhere in this game. And that first half was super impressive, because that was really, I think, when I saw the way he played in the first half, said I didn't care how much the Lakers were winning or in at halftime, Nuggets were going to win just because of off of Aaron Gordon's play.
If you want to see a player playing with 1,000% urgency, and I don't just mean like physical flying around urgency, although Aaron Gordon was doing that, I mean such locked in mental engagement, moving around the floor defensively, knowing where to be and when. Oh, there's an emergency over there. I got to suddenly be there, but then I'm going to get back here. Aaron Gordon in the first half, keeping them connected in this game, was absolutely everywhere on defense. He was everywhere on defense when Jokic was in foul trouble and they had to start moving Jokic around. Jokic guarded Gabe Vincent for parts of this game because the Lakers were playing three guards and LeBron and AD, and they wanted to protect him from both LeBron and AD, and that was the only way they could do it. And when Jokic was on the bench, just everywhere. And by the way, one of the stories of this series, if my math is right, after three games now, the Nuggets are plus one in the non-Jokic minutes. You're dead. You're dead. Yeah. If those minutes are neutral, you're dead. They were neutral. They were more than neutral tonight. They were plus tonight. And, you know, the Lakers went back to AD on Jokic instead of AD on Aaron Gordon as the rover. And it exposes the back line with, like, once you engage AD in the pick and roll and Jamal Murray turns the corner at all, there's nobody back there to stop him. And he gets to the rim, and a lot of those Aaron Gordon offensive rebounds are at the rim. The other unsung hero, by the way, because they had to do it a little bit tonight, the Nuggets also, you know, much was made deservedly so of their adjustment in game two of moving Jokic to Hachimura and Gordon on Davis to kind of muck up the Lakers pick and roll attack. Like, okay, you want to go at Jokic? You got to use Rui. And if Rui rolls to the rim, he's rolling right into AD and you got a lot of traffic. Well, they went back, as I suspected they would. I said on TV, I think they're going to go probably back to Jokic on AD. And then they had to switch it around again to go back the other way. And Aaron Gordon, deservedly so, gets a lot of praise for being able to guard Anthony Davis pretty well. I think the Nuggets are told, you want to force feed Anthony Davis post up against Aaron Gordon? Go ahead. Like, he had some success, but that's fine. Yeah. The other unsung hero of that scheme is KCP being able to guard LeBron James, because someone's got to guard LeBron. That's Aaron Gordon's job, but it's not his job anymore. KCP does really well considering the size discrepancy in that matchup. He had another great defensive game tonight. And MPJ, it's not just the shots, which always just seem like these, like, okay, Jokic is on the bench, we got him win these minutes. Oh, Michael Porter just made a 22-foot off the dribble, foot on the line dagger in my face. He made plays off the dribble tonight and as a passer that were out of his game, out of his range, probably a season and a half ago. This starting five is just, it's a perfect basketball starting five. And it's going to take an A-plus game from any team to beat them. And it's going to take a bad bench game for Denver to lose. I mean, some of these teams are, I think Minnesota in the next round could put up a great challenge potentially against Denver if they get by Phoenix. But you got to be on your A-plus game to beat this team, because they don't beat themselves. And they're just a ruthless efficiency machine on offense. I mean, it is just how calculated and calm they are. It all flows out from Jokic, but I wanted to shout out some of those guys too.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to the continuity, having that starting five together for as long as they've had. They all know where everybody's supposed to be, where they're supposed to go. When this guy cuts here, I'm going to move there. When Jokic has the ball at the elbow, we're going to do, you know, whatever, exchange on the weak side or whatnot, and then one of us will flash to the basket. Gordon has mastered kind of working the baseline perfectly with Jokic, and whether it's a Jokic Murray pick and roll and then he gets a dunk off of that, or if it's just a Jokic post up. And then it's the other way around too. There are plays where it's like on post ups where Gordon had one. I think it was game one. There's a great example of Gordon has a post up and Jokic just ducks in. I think he had Rui on him, and it's an easy bucket, and Gordon finds him. Like, the unselfishness across the board from the team, it all starts from Jokic, but it's kind of spread to everybody kind of making the right reads and the passes and being quick with it. I mean, it's going to be real tough to see, you know, a team beat him. The one thing that's probably concerning, if we're going to talk about the Nuggets a little bit, is Reggie Jackson kind of rolling his ankle pretty bad. Like, that's another blow to their bench.
Yeah, they don't have a lot of margin for that either.
It's concerning, and that's something we're going to have to be monitor there. Now, the hope for them is, yo, just win this game on Saturday and buy us as much time. Let's hope Phoenix and Minnesota goes seven, and we have a lot of time before the next series. And I think that's just their mentality has got to be, hey, we got to take care of business on Saturday.
Well, the Lakers are staring at, again, LeBron is extension eligible. He's eligible for a lot of money. He's almost 40 years old. Still obviously an all NBA level player, but, you know, he's almost 40. There's the Bronny variable. See where that ends up. I've said before, as there's been noise, there's just noise off and on, you know, about where LeBron will end his career. The last time there was noise, it was the Warriors. Remember the Warriors, by the way? They've been gone for a while now. They tried to at least engage the idea of maybe trading for LeBron James. Not sure the Warriors have totally given up on that possibility. But I've said all along, I think LeBron wants to remain a Laker for the rest of his career. I think that's his intention. I don't think that's absolute. Nothing is absolute, but I think he would like to remain a Laker. D'Lo, it's just incredible how the Nuggets just destroy D'Lo in a week. Like, it's just the Lakers fans, now they want him out after defending him all year. I apologize to him for putting him in a million fake trades and saying no matter how well he plays, his teams don't seem to really like him that much. And then comes out and does this. Hachimura was invisible, weirdly, for the whole series. And then the Lakers' defense, yeah, like Christian Wood couldn't play and Jared Vanderbilt couldn't play and Gabe Vincent has essentially had a lost season. I just don't think any of those guys are making a difference in this series in terms of the outcome. And look, they're going to go out. They're just not going to run back this team the way it is right now next season, if indeed LeBron and AD are both back. I think there's going to be a lot of noise about Darvin Hammond. We'll see what they do. We'll see what they do about that. Jeannie Buss has gone to bat for him before, but if they get swept again, I think that, like, they've done it. The interesting thing about the Lakers, Mo, is that we've put the Russ trade so far in the rearview mirror that we kind of forget they're still digging their way. They're still, like, paying a little ripple effects from that are still rippling across their roster. And for them to do that trade and also let Caruso walk, which was a massive blow to their team. And now they save themselves by finding Reeves and incorporating Reeves into their team. But for them to get to the conference finals last year, albeit in a little bit of a down year for the West, but still, and, you know, look, they just drew the wrong team in the first round. They're a good team built around a guy who's almost 40, and AD played well the entire season. Like, these have been a couple of pretty good seasons for the Lakers. It's just, it's hard to be better than that when your best player is 40 and you have two guys making $120 million combined or whatever they're going to end up making.
Yeah, and then just even going back to the Westbrook trade, like, it's got to kill them that KCP is such a key part to the Nuggets, because that was one of the major pieces that they moved. Like, you know, that trade never really made a ton of sense, and I think that's just the situation. And now every time they play the Nuggets, they have that reminder in KCP, who's making big plays along those lines. I'm just going to throw it out there. I want to see them get Trae Young. I think if LeBron's sticking around, I think LeBron, AD, and I think Trae Young kind of playing a little bit more of that Kyrie Irving role, kind of looking back to the Cleveland days, I think is actually a pretty good fit for the Lakers.
That's another road not taken for the Lakers. I'm not sure how realistic it really was last year when he was being traded off of Brooklyn, but, you know, I mean, LeBron obviously lobbied for it as publicly as he's ever, and specifically, not passive aggressively, not hourglass tweet, not subtle, like specifically.
Yeah, get that guy. And I think seeing that they didn't get him, I think you got to make a run at Trey. I think that's kind of looking forward into them, and that allows them, young guy also takes a little pressure off LeBron. I think that'd be the move I'd be targeting if I was the Lakers. But they got a lot of questions to answer, as you've kind of announced, and they're paying for a lot of their old sins. I mean, it felt like for a good 2 or 3 years after they won the bubble title, they made every mistake you could possibly make after that for the next 2 years. And I think now they're trying to figure their way out of it.
We had a little thing on the show today where they gave us dry erase boards, and like a game show, we had to like write down our answers to questions rapid fire. And one of the questions was, because they were going to announce the Clutch Player of the Year award tonight, and which went to Steph Curry, who's the best clutch player in the NBA? Not this year. Who's the best clutch player in the NBA? I wrote down Jokic. I think Jokic is the best clutch player in the NBA. He shot 55% in crunch time this year. 55%, I think it was 42 of 76. Doesn't turn the ball over. Obviously makes the right play every time. Denver was neck and neck with Chicago, bizarrely, as the best crunch time team. And if you look at Jokic, crunch time is the domain of ball handlers, right? Like, that's why Dirk was such an anomaly in crunch time, because big guys, they need someone to give them the ball. It's harder to get them the ball. A lot of them aren't great jump shooters. Crunch time is the purview of perimeter stars. Jokic is going to go down as the greatest crunch time big man in NBA history. It's just uncanny what he does late in these games. And I just want to go back to that Jamal Murray game winner from game two, because I didn't get to talk about it yet. First of all, what will get lost to history is the play where Jokic threw this bizarre, he like barfed up this heave of a pass that somehow landed in Aaron Gordon's hands under the rim, and he kicked it out to Michael Porter Jr. for, I believe, a game-tying three.
Right.
Then Jamal Murray hits a crazy jumper before the crazy jumper. And then on the last play, if you watch that Jokic, Murray-Jokic two-man game, there's like they switch, obviously, because the shot ends up over Anthony Davis. There's a moment where Jokic has post position at the nail against LeBron and could have demanded the ball. And it's Nikola Jokic with LeBron. He's got a big size advantage. And I don't know what was exchanged in that moment between them. Probably they can't talk. Probably just a glance. Maybe not even a glance. Maybe just a feel. Jokic was like, no, you know what? No, I'm going to go set a screen for you. This is yours. And there's just something about the chemistry of this team and how they operate under pressure that is really, really special. And I know they've only won one championship, and I don't think they're invulnerable in the West this year. I think there are teams that could push them, particularly Minnesota, and the winner of the – I'll just say particularly Minnesota, because that's looming next round potentially. We'll talk about that series. But this is a really – well-constructed basketball machine. Every part – not only fits together, but every player complements the strengths of every other player and supports the weaknesses, to the extent that any of the players have any, of each other. It's a beautiful team to watch. And once again, they're just mowing the Lakers out of the playoffs.
Yeah, and extremely well coached with Michael Malone too. Like, I think, you know, the right coach is in charge with this group. And all of them having been together for as long as they've been together. And when we talk about team chemistry, we forget to mention the coach's involvement in that. Because the coach being able to coach his stars or know when to pull back or what buttons to push and all that, I think is also a key element there.
Well, and, you know, I mentioned Jokic's clutch play and how big guys need to have the ball fed to them. This is the second straight game where Anthony Davis, it was invisible in the fourth quarter. Yeah. And I think he's a traditional big man in that sense. Like, you can almost he needs the ball fed to him. He is not a great one-on-one creator. He had some takes tonight that were great. Like, if you give him space to eat up, or a matchup that's comfortable, or he sees a seam on the baseline and no help defender, like, he's good at that. But that's just not his game. But the Lakers, I think, two straight games have been guilty of kind of forgetting about him. Yeah. And maybe that's his fault too. But anyway, well, Lakers Warriors. Bye. Goodbye. should we? I guess we got to talk about Cavs Magic. Sorry. The Magic won by 1,000 points. Jalen Suggs was amazing, guarded Donovan Mitchell. They switched up that matchup. Wendell Carter Jr. started for the Magic. And the Magic just came out like you would expect a team that is down 2-0 and hasn't won a playoff game in a gazillion years, hasn't had a home playoff game in a gazillion years. And the Cleveland Cavaliers came out like they kind of were assigned to play the game by the NBA and didn't really particularly want to be there. Darius Garland, 2 of 10, 5 points, completely invisible. Donovan Mitchell was decent at times. Caris LeVert played with some oomph. At some points, Tristan Thompson and Marcus Morris were in the game. Paolo Banchero, 31 points, 14 rebounds, 5 assists. And if you want, if you're my age and you like the 90s and you miss the 90s, just go watch Paolo Banchero's shots from this game, because it's fadeaway jumpers, it's turnaround two-point jumpers, it's face-up attack 18-footers, just eating up smaller defenders. And the Magic went to their, I call it their mega lineup for a lot of this game, which is one guard, usually Suggs, Franz Wagner at the two, Banchero, I guess, is the three, Isaac and a center, Wendell Carter, or Mo Wagner. By the way, congrats to Mo Wagner. I did not have within one half of Mo Wagner causing a fracas in this series. He got it done second quarter of game one.
Don't doubt Mo's. We find Zach. Don't find.
I guess that's true. And Paolo Banchero in that alignment was having his way with smaller defenders, whether it was Isaac Okoro or Caris LeVert or whoever he found on him. And Isaac made more of an impact off the bench than he did as a starter. And they just made shots. Like, they weren't making any shots. And then they made shots. I thought Cleveland just had no juice. And forgive me if I would like a team that has proven nothing in the playoffs to have a little juice to go up. Like, I thought they were going to come out and be like, we're taking this series by the throat. We're leaving nothing to chance. Nothing. We're not going to leave it to chance that we come out in game four up 2-1 and have an Orlando Magic shooting game from the first two games. And suddenly it's 2-2 and our home crowd's getting nervous. We're not even going to leave that to chance. We're going to come in here and run you over. And they got run over by a truck and never recovered.
I think one guy that deserves a lot of credit was the aggression that the Magic got from Franz Wagner in the first quarter. 10 points in the first quarter. I thought he was super aggressive with how he attacked, was taking it to the rim, was looking to score, it's been a down year for Franz, but I think like this is one of those things where this was a game where you felt like, oh, he's bringing it tonight. And then from that, I think that built everything up for the Magic. I mean, Paolo. He's a star. Like I'm all in and excited for this kid going forward. Suggs brings a certain element of just like kind of F you, I'm going. I got this and I'm going to fight. He had a nasty dunk down the lane. And I think, you know, again, it's just the aggression and the way they played. Like this was a Magic team that looked very comfortable, whereas they looked so uncomfortable. I understood it in game one, it being their first playoff series for most of those guys. It took them a second. And I think finding their rhythm and their flow, and in game two, they just kind of got buried, but this one was a comfortable Magic team. And I think this is the thing that the Cavs got to be afraid of. Don't ever give this dude light. It's a diehard reference when John McClane's, you know, crawling underneath the table and the guy's trying to shoot at him. And he tells him, if you ever have a chance to kill someone, don't hesitate. And McClane says, yeah, sure. And then starts shooting the guy. And it's like, okay, that's the moment. Like, that's the thing. You can't hesitate. And I think the Cavs hesitated. And I won't be shocked if this comes back to bite him.
They finally got something out of Cole Anthony, who had done nothing in this series. And when Cole Anthony runs a pick and roll, you have to actually honor his jump shot, whether it's with Banchero. He ran a couple of pick and rolls with Franz in this game. It's like, oh, that's a real pick and roll. Like, we have to actually do stuff. It's not two non-shooters in a two-man game that we're not scared of. Not much else really from this game, except that the Cavs just had no life. And I thought they would win. I picked the Cavs to win this series, and I still think they will. But, you know, this is one of the reasons that they're a little hard to trust. Like, as soon as, even in the regular season, as soon as they get a rhythm okay, this is how a rotation works. We stagger this way. One of the bigs plays with a shooter, and Niang comes in here, and Okoro comes in here. Strus can play some power forward. They've done that a little bit the last two games. They just lose it, and their rhythm kind of eludes them. And, you know, here we are, game four. Suddenly a big game. I'm trying to think if there was anything else from that game. I just... George Niang trying to score on Jonathan Isaac was endlessly amusing to
like,
me.
Like, what are we doing here?
That is an athletic mismatch of the first order. I mean, and George Niang's crafty and like moves people around, and Jonathan Isaac is just like a velociraptor out there to just taking up every inch of the court.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes! Catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So who's there up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, watch out for them, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish, but you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facility safe and your people safer. Call or click Grainger.com or just stop by.
Let's move to, we have three game threes tomorrow night. Minnesota Phoenix, Dallas Clippers, and Bucks Pacers, with Chris Middleton now listed as questionable. Which would be obviously a disaster for the Bucks, yes, given that they would be running out of their good players at that point. Which of those games are you? How about this? Which team are you most curious to watch tomorrow, or which team do you feel like is under the most pressure tomorrow of those games?
I think it's the Clippers.
Interesting. All right, let's get into it.
You know, I think I know. I think the easy answer is Phoenix, but I think the Clippers are still under more pressure, in the sense of, look, Kawhi came back in game two, did not look good, at least in the first half, had some stuff in the second half, looked a little bit more comfortable in the second half, but still didn't really get rolling. I think the Mavs have kind of figured out how they want to attack, how they're going to approach the rest of the series and the way they're going to kind of go at it. And I think they found a nice little small ball lineup. I think PJ Washington hitting shots. I think Kleba hitting a huge three with about 2 minutes left to put them up six was a big moment for him.
That was the biggest shot of the game. And it felt like Dallas was in prevent offense mode too early, and it might cost them the game. And Kleba bailed them out.
Yeah, it was huge. And I think there's a lot of that stuff. And just knowing, again, like when we just talked about the Lakers' future, looking at the Clippers' future, again, you talked about it. Paul George will probably sign the extension, but he hasn't. So we have to be a little bit aware of that. You're constantly worried of this is another playoffs where Kawhi wasn't ready for a game one. Like, this is kind of worrisome. You have James Harden kind of floating around. Like, what's the plan going forward with this team moving into a new arena? I think this is the team that has the most pressure on them, I think, in the playoffs. And I think this is the big matchup for them. I think the Mavs are hungry. I think they got the jitters out after game one. I think there's a element for the Mavs of, like, this is their moment to finally put away the team that's put them on ice for two years. I think this is a big time. Big game three right here is going to be huge.
It's the biggest game of the playoffs so far, is this game, because it's 1-1 and it's two teams that have put everything into this season. All their draft pick eggs are in the basket.
Yeah.
I thought game two was a strange game. Very slow, very station to station. It was almost like the cliche of the fighters kind of feeling themselves out. You could see, okay, if I do this, what are you going to do? Okay, you're going to do that. All right. Well, I don't like that so much. But if I go here and give the ball to this guy, what's your reaction? Okay, I kind of like that better. Oh, there's two on the shot clock. And it was just a very slow, just testing it out. Just testing, you know. And you have all these stars. You have five legit star level ball handlers, and a sixth off the Hall of Famer coming off the bench, and Russ. and they're all equipped to play. It was almost like, do we want to play pick and roll like Harden Zubats, Luka Gafford, Luka Lively, and play out of that? Or do we want to go mismatch hunting a little bit because we have all these accomplished mismatch hunters on our team? And Dallas in particular has some guys that we think we can pick on a little bit. All those guys stood up to it, yeah, including Luka, pretty goddamn well.
Yeah.
And Kyrie too. Kyrie was the primary defender on James Harden. And that's the math problem that the Mavs face in this series. They have two perimeter stars, and the Clippers, when they have all of them on the court, have three. And that means one of the Dallas guys is going to have to guard one of the Clippers guys. And that was Kyrie on Harden for a lot of the series, a lot of game two. But it just felt like neither team had any kind of rhythm or decisiveness to their offense. And when you have Luka and Kawhi and Harden, you don't always need that. But I just came away feeling like the series almost hasn't started yet. Like no one has found the right card to play. In fact, they look like mirror images of each other. Like one star would get a good matchup, like Paul George would draw Luka, or Harden would have whoever, and then they would double them. They would run up and double and force you to rotate out of it and pass out of it, and the defense would rotate underneath it. And it's like, okay, I'm watching the same game. And it just feels like whatever team finds the right blend on offense between their system and hunting mismatches so that you're kind of doing both within the same possession a little bit more organically is going to win the series. I weirdly felt okay about the Clippers coming out of that game. I felt better than most people seem to. I thought Kawhi looked pretty good, all things considered, particularly on defense. Like he had four steals. He looked athletic. He had a pretty explosive putback. I know he missed his shots. He missed all his threes. I have no idea who's going to win this series. I picked the Mavs in seven because of the Kawhi uncertainty. I actually think the Clippers are a better team. But I, in a weird way, I feel like the series is almost not started.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great way of putting it in just that sense, because like being at the game, it was an ugly game, like in the way it kind of played out for a while until like both teams started to find a little bit more of an offensive flow in like the last 6 minutes, where we started to kind of see a little bit more of that. I think, you know, the thing that concerns me just with the Clippers sometimes is there's a level of just like they're not sure who's supposed to go attack. Like Paul George was outstanding in game one. And he had moments in game two, but I didn't really feel him in game two in the way that he stood out in game one. And part of it was, yeah, there was no Kawhi. It was all him. A lot of the part of the game for the Clippers was trying to get Kawhi in rhythm and get him going, almost like knock off some rust off of him. And I think that kind of held them back in that regard. I'm not like, I picked the Mavs, but I'm not like worried about the Clippers yet in this series. Because again, I don't feel like anybody, like you said, has really found something where it's like, okay, well, what are you going to do now? What's your magical adjustment that you're going to make? How are you going to figure things out? I don't think either team has shown anything to the other team yet.
And there are interesting lineup quandaries in this series too. You know, the Mavs have aimed some of their most important transactions of the last 2 years at not playing Kleba at center. You know, they tank to make sure they keep their own pick and they use it via trade on Lively. Then they trade a lot of stuff, some stuff for Gafford. All right, we have two traditional centers now. Well, the look that got you to the conference finals 2 years ago was Kleba at the five and five shooters on the floor. And that look is still working. And it's worked really well this season, and it's worked really well in this series. They're plus 24 with Kleba as the only big man on the floor in two games in this series. The Clippers have to decide, well, how do we want to deal with that? You saw Ty Lue go to his five wings lineup. Didn't think Terrence Mann played enough in game two. I like that lineup when all five guys can shoot threes. Russ played over Terrence Mann, and that's fine. Russ was playing well, not shooting well. He was just being Russ, just causing havoc. I think Zubats has played so well that I'm not ready to take him off the floor just because the Mavericks play whatever lineup. I think Zubats has been one of the five best Clippers so far through two games. It's just an interesting series. There's one play the Clippers ran in the fourth quarter. I'm sure you saw it. They ran it twice, and it was James Harden setting a back screen for Kawhi in the paint, designed to get Kyrie switched onto Kawhi. And then Harden would come up and run a handoff with Zubats. Zubats would come down and set a pin down for Kawhi so he could catch with Kyrie on his back. Didn't lead to anything. But like, that's the kind of stuff I want the Clippers to run. And I want them to run it in a way that it's like, we have time on the clock to run something after that, too. Right. When they start playing like that, I feel like they're the better team in this series, but they're going to have to start to play like that. My answer to my own question was going to be Phoenix, who has gotten absolutely destroyed by the Wolves through two games. Series doesn't start until the road team wins. What if the home team wins every game by a million points? Has it started by then? This series feels like it started. And credit to the Wolves. I absolutely adore the way Anthony Edwards is playing in this series. The easy passes he's making, the simple reads, the extra passes he's playing beautifully. Mike Conley was essential in their game two win. Phoenix looks alternatively like a team that knows how it should play and can execute it, and a team that has absolutely no idea that Kevin Durant is on the team or how to play at all. And all of a sudden, Yusuf Nurkic is trying to post up Rudy Gobert from 18 feet away and 19 dribbles, or Drew Eubanks is taking a floater late in the shot clock and Kevin Durant hasn't moved in 20 seconds. And you're just like, what the hell is going on? Like, I don't understand. Brad Beal missed 20, 30 games, whatever. Like, now Grayson Allen turned his ankle. I think Minnesota's coming for blood in these two games in Phoenix. And I think they're going to get, if you ask me right now, I think Minnesota's getting one of these games in Phoenix. I don't think Phoenix is going to win, but now they could surprise me. They have this. I know the talent. I know the names. They just can't seem to put four quarters of coherent basketball together. And when they go incoherent, they go really incoherent.
It's just tough to watch. To be honest, like, I watch them and I go, you know, I love the X's and O's and everything that goes with it. And it's, I just look at what they're doing offensively and I'm like, this team has no idea how they want to attack, where they want to go. They have no system in place, no concept even of what we want to do. Every now and then they run maybe a stack or a Spain pick and roll. And that's like the closest thing we get into stuff.
And it works. And then like whoever has Mike Conley will set a screen for Durant and get a switch, or Durant will attack the Cat matchup in a way that makes sense. Although Cat and Gobert are holding their own in perimeter matchups. And if Cat's holding his own, given the level of defense around him, you're in a world of hurt. And they'll execute like, oh, that's the kind of play they should run more. And then for 8 minutes, it'll be like, if these guys, they know this is a playoff game, do they have a playbook? Does anyone, do they have names for plays? Is anyone calling anything out?
It's just like they don't play off of each other. They don't work with each other and how to go. Like, I don't know. It just kind of makes sense to me. Like, with those three guys, run some sort of three-man game or horns action or even what the Kings used to run under Rick Adelman in an elbow game or whatnot. Nurkic is good out of the elbow in terms of his passing and things like that. Play through him in some of these things. They just don't have any of that. And it's weird to me in that sense. And I kind of just look at it going like, what did you do all season when you're developing? Because it's not, you're not in a position defensively where at least I can go like, well, they just invested all their time defensively. Like, I just don't see really what they're going for. And when you talk about the Wolves being out for blood, Anthony Edwards is looking to just gut them every chance he gets. And it's to be honest, it's kind of fun to watch. Like, you know, in game two, it wasn't a particularly great shot. It was all great offense, but he goes one-on-one on KD and hits a pull-up jumper after a series of dribbles. And it's just like, and he's just giving KD that look again. And it's, you know, we saw the video from game one and all the trash talk he's giving it. He's giving it to everybody there. He's making a lot of smart plays and a lot of smart reads out of that.
I love like the way Anthony
they're Edwards coming
is,
for them.
He's playing. I know he didn't shoot well in game two. I thought he played an awesome game. Like, just, you send two to me, here's the easy pass, the ball's going to swing around, Jaden McDaniels is going to make a play, Naz Reid's going to make a play, the ball might come back to me, and then I'll make a play. He played fantastic basketball. Gobert has been awesome. And Chris Finch has a good pulse for this team. It's the simple little things he does. Like, when he takes Gobert out, so their best defensive player is out, and they'll play with Reid, with Naz Reid and Towns together, much more minimally, one of the two bigs is the only big. When Gobert comes out, you'll often notice Nikhil Alexander-Walker comes in for Mike Conley. Right. And it's one of those things like, we're hurting our defense up front, but we're going to help it on the perimeter so that we kind of net out. Okay, Chris Finch is a really good coach, and this team is playing really hard. And just really, I mean, compared to Phoenix, they don't have, well, you know, the talent differential on offense is not is actually not very big because they have Ant and Cat, and Phoenix has three obviously accomplished all-star players. But Minnesota just is playing with a lot more focus and a lot more sort of just focus. They're sharing the ball. They're sharing the wealth. They're moving. They're cutting. They're playing good basketball. I'll say this. If Phoenix splits at home, they're not going to win the series. It's very hard to win down 3-1 when you have 5-7 on the road. Obviously, it would behoove them to win two games at home. If they win two games at home, the series is obviously up for grabs. Totally up for grabs. They're fully capable of doing that. This is a 49-win team. This is not some also-ran team. This is a very good team. They have not looked good in this series. Let's say they split, and it's 3-1, and they end up losing in 5 or 6. It's a competitive series loss, at least in terms of the number of games. The manner in which that happens is going to be very, very important for what happens in the summer for Phoenix, because if this team goes out, frankly, like they've gone out the past two seasons in embarrassing fashion, Matt Ishbia, anything's possible. And they've undergone a lot of roster turmoil in the last year and a half, and it does not appear to have gotten them where they think that they should go. And I would just be very interested to see what happens. Mo, we must talk about the Miami Heat.
I knew we were going there.
I mean, my God, the Heat. I should have known.
It's just...
I should have known. Like, Celtics in 4. That was my pick. No Jimmy Butler. No Terry Rozier. Tyler Hero is just coming back from injury. Duncan Robinson's coming back from injury. Kevin Love's coming back from injury. Eric Spoelstra's goatee is coming in nicely. Joe Mazzulla's watching the town. I should have known. And so here come the Heat. It's the most inexplicable. The Celtics destroy them in game one. Destroy them. And I write off the series. I'm like, this is the series. It's going to be over fast. And the Heat are like, oh, you want it over fast? How about no? How about we make 23 threes, some of which were bad Boston defense. Like, you don't need to help on the strong side corner. You don't need to do that. Some of it was just closing out short as a scheme. Okay. Drew Holiday I've talked about the Drew Holiday roller coaster before in the playoffs. Some games it's like, wait, why did you just take a 1-on-4 3 and then throw the ball into the stands? Kristaps Porzingis. And the Heat.
Just Miami, man.
Like, they just do it. They just like... They find it's the hashtag Heat culture, toughest playing, stupidest court, whatever. Like, they just do it. They made all the threes. Bam made every mid-range shot. Hero played a really great game. Like, if you rewatch Hero's pick and rolls in that game, a lot of the breakdowns that the Celtics had were caused by how decisive Tyler Hero was. He was fast, decisive, more north-south than he usually is, and he had the Celtics on the back foot as a result. I still think they're drawing dead in this series. I right now, if you ask me, we did on the show today, how many games are the Heat winning in this series? I said 1. I'm expecting the Celtics to come out and treat this game as a wake-up call and beat them twice in Miami and close it out at home. What did you see? Okay, so I talked about the Heat. They were great. What of this was alarming to you from the Celtics perspective, as we assume that they're just going to walk all over this team? And once again, they do not.
I think the most alarming of it was, one, Porzingis not able to take advantage of the switches. Then that was the change that Miami made, was they just went into, we're switching everything and we don't care if Tyler Hero ends up on Porzingis. And he just couldn't take advantage of that. And I think that was really interesting. But I think the other thing that was very fascinating was they limited the Celtics 3-point attempts. And I think that was the more important thing. Celtics shot, I think, like 49 threes in game one and 32 in game two. That wasn't an accident. That wasn't just the Celtics decided not to take threes. I thought they did a great job running guys off of the line, making them live a little bit more in the mid-range. I thought they looked to try to attack them a bit more and just saying, like, we're going to pressure up. Every time we switch, we're not going to switch so that you can just get an easy three. We're going to switch up and into you. Like, there's an example where Duncan Robinson switches into Jaylen Brown when he comes off of a dribble handoff. And he's up right into him, meets him body to body, and then strips him right after that because he's right into him. Like, they gave them no airspace at the three-point line. And I think that was a key factor in that win for them, in just that they were able to limit the Celtics' three-point shot and force them to play inside the arc. And I think that's an interesting thing. I don't know if the Heat can replicate it, but I think if I'm another team that's getting ready to game plan against the Celtics, I'm taking note of that. Because I think that's an important thing to watch for in the Celtics' run is, you know, how often are they going to get the three-point shots that they want off?
I also, if I'm another team, taking note of Spo's decision to put Tyler Herro on Jaylen Brown. We saw the Warriors do this when they put Draymond Green on Jaylen Brown. And the Warriors' version was, we're just not going to guard you. Like, you want to take a million threes, and it did not work. Jaylen Brown took a million threes, and you made a million threes. This was more like, we're going to put our weakest defender on you. We're not going to not guard you, though. We're going to guard you. And so, if you want to exploit it, you got to find ways to do that either on your own by playing bully ball or in some screening actions that are not normally part necessarily of your A-plus repertoire. Stan Van Gundy called that out immediately on the broadcast. It was, I was writing it in my notes as he was saying it. I think they were trying to bait the Celtics into getting out of their offense to go at Tyler Herro with Jaylen Brown, and specifically Jaylen Brown. I think something Stan did not say is also relevant, and this is what I would replicate going, but it's just something to watch. I think an intentional trickle-down effect of that matchup, I don't think it's an accident, is that with the weakest defender on Jaylen Brown, you know where the weakest defender was not? On Derek White. And right. That's where the weakest defender usually is by default. And because of that, that unlocks the best part of the Celtics offense, which is Derek White screening on the ball, off the ball, randomly all over the place for Tatum and for Brown, specifically to put your smallest and worst defender into the action against those guys. You can still do that with Jaylen Brown, as with Tyler Herro, if you can go screen for Jason Tatum. He doesn't have the same juice and randomness and flow and sort of basketball intuition as Derek White. Derek White, because of how teams match up against Boston, has been the engine or co-engine of all their best stuff. And they took Derek White out of the game. I know he had okay box score stats. You did not feel his involvement in the same way. And I think that was directly related to Jason Tatum taking two shots in the fourth quarter. He also drew two shooting fouls, missed two free throws on a big trip that actually could have swung that game. I thought that was also related to Jason Tatum's relative lack of involvement compared to someone of his stature. I think that Herro matchup is as much about White as it is about Brown, and I think it was really smart. I think the way they moved Bam around was really smart. You guard Tatum, but when Haywood Highsmith's in the game, he's going to guard Tatum. You can go back to being Bam and roving around and guarding the opposing big men. It's just, man, Spo's a great coach, and this team, like, we see it all the time. Low seeds who are undermanned and injured, they just roll over. They come into the playoffs, they roll over. These guys are never, ever going to roll over. They're going to make you earn every single win, and the Celtics did not play well. They were aimless. They were not good defensively. I hope it's for their sake that it's a wake-up call. I just don't think the Heat have any chance to win this series, but I'll tell you this. If we wake up in like 10 days and it's Heat Celtics game 7 in Boston,
oh my God.
I am going to be on a train to go to that game because it would be the most this series should not last long. Like, it just shouldn't. And Celtics better win game 3.
Well, that's the thing, right? It really comes down to game 3. And I think that's going to be the
Can you imagine right if there. Boston is down 2-1 in Miami in game 4 without Jimmy Butler? It will be insane.
Oh, it will explode. The internet will explode in that sense. And everything that we see and all the memes and all the times where everybody said, like, hey, Boston loses, everybody panics. This is wild. Right? If they were to go down. This is assuming they
can't lose in a normal way. Boston just can't lose a normal game.
No, it's that simple. And I think that's one of those things. Because I was with you after game one. Man, this thing's over. I picked it in five, and I was kicking myself that I didn't predict a sweep. And it was just along those lines. And even in that game, going, yeah, like, I get it. Miami hit 23 threes. Like, maybe they don't shoot 50% again from three. But I would say it feels like every time they do in a playoff game, it's against Boston. And some of it, again, is just the threes they get and the opportunities. But everybody seems to step up for them over and over again. And when you're just looking at it, if Boston's in a situation where they're down at any point in this series against Miami, like, you have to then start looking, even if they win it, you have to start wondering, like, okay, well, what's this team really about? Like, what are they? And I think that's going to be the real question that we're going to be facing if that's to happen. I don't think it is. I think it's a five-game series still. I think they get the two in Miami, and we kind of feel a little bit more like, oh, wow, they're finally going to vanquish their demons.
The Heat.
Just getting one game is a win for the Heat, by the way. Like, that's, like, in the situation that they're in and the way they did it. Like, that's impressive. That was the most amped I've seen Pat Riley in the stands.
Riles, you know? Though, they travel. The Heat travel. First of all, they're all very well-dressed, and they look impeccable, and they don't – they sit in the stands. They sit in the stands, even though they're super-duper famous. This is not like random GMs and assistant GMs who, like, regular people don't know. It's Pat Riley and Alonzo Mourning, and they're just amid the Boston fans, just right. Loving – looking great and loving life.
Bleep Boston, sitting in the face, sitting right with the fans.
Because who's messing with Pat Riley? Who's going to mess with Pat Riley?
Nobody. I'm not. Nobody.
And you know what will happen? You know, sitting next to him is Alonzo Mourning. The freaking weight room in Miami's arena is named the Zozone because that dude can beat the hell out of anybody. Unbelievable, the Heat. I'm watching the game. I'm laughing. Like, I can't believe they're going to win this game. Caleb Martin three is going in. It's going in.
I went through my Twitch stream to break down the threes, to break down Hero's assists, and then just some of their defense. It was an impressive performance with the way they played, though. It was flying around. The way they flew around on defense. I mean, there are clips of, you know, Bam going from the opposite block to go to the corner to contest a shot and getting there in time to actually make it a legitimate contest and not one of those fake late contests where you're like, the guy didn't even see you as he shot it, like actually affecting the shot. And I think there was just a lot of those plays and clips in that for that team. That's just super impressive.
Let's talk for just 5 minutes, if you will indulge me, about Oklahoma City, New Orleans. Milwaukee, Indiana is super interesting, and it was a great win for the Pacers. They're playing, by the time this goes up, it will be today. They're playing today, and the Middleton injury thing is just a big unknown. I'm excited to watch the game, Indiana. My worry for the Bucks is that without Giannis, they're very, very small and very challenged defensively.
And athletically.
They cannot win a shootout against Indiana. And they need Dame to go nuts, and they need to otherwise kind of slow and grind the game. Post up Brook Lopez on Siakam. I'm a little worried how small they look. Oklahoma City, New Orleans. Thunder are up 2-0, blew them out in game two. Obviously, game one went down to the wire. Shea made an incredible shot. What is interesting to you? I think this is actually quite an interesting sort of strategic series, pivoting around the centers, Chet Holmgren and Jonas Valanciunas. What has been interesting to you other than the Dortcher chamber? The Dortcher chamber is in full effect. You want to have a blast watching old school NBA basketball. Third quarter of game two, four possessions in a row. The Pelicans run the same pin down play to just try like all hell to get Lou Dort off of Brandon Ingram. They come out and they screen. I don't know who. I think it was Trey Murphy. I can't remember. Screens Lou Dort along the baseline, and Brandon Ingram's supposed to curl up toward the foul line and catch the ball, hopefully with Lou Dort not on him. And Lou Dort just refuses to participate in the whole thing. He's like, oh, a screen? I'm Lou Dort. I don't get screened. It's incredible theater. It reminded me of Tony Allen actually navigating screens against Kevin Durant. Like, just the screen is just magically irrelevant. Anyway, what has stood out to you about this series other than the Thunder looking awesome?
I mean, it's the Chet Valanciunas series. You know, it's that battle right there. Like, that's really the more important thing there. I think that opens that matters the most in terms of this series. And I think there were plays where Valanciunas was bullying Chet and bodying him and backing him down. And then when he turns to shoot, Chet's right there to block the shot. Like, it's just unfazed in that sense. And, you know, all the talk of him being too skinny and not being able to hold up, he's holding up really well in that regard. And I think the other aspect too is just Valanciunas is doing a pretty good job on the boards, but it just, they can't compete, man. Like, he can't compete with them on the other side of the court. You know, like, Chet with his mobility is able to just kind of blow by him over and over again. Like, game two was a perfect encapsulation. I don't think I said that word right, but perfect example of just everything Chet can do offensively. Trail three, drilled it. Catch and shoot threes if you in pick and pop opportunities, drilled it. Grab and go rebounds, bringing the ball up the court, hit his man with a little shake and get to the rim. Times where one play where he does that and Ingram helps off the strong side corner. Cool. He kicks it. I think it was to Lou Dort who did a sidestep three. Like, there's just all of those little nuances and stuff you're seeing in Chet's game that you're just watching. And it just makes you, it makes me fear for the future. For anybody that has to play Oklahoma City in the future, I don't know what their playoff future for this year is going to look like, but just the next few seasons, like, watching this team grow is going to be just amazing.
I wouldn't sleep on the present. And I've been saying all year, like, you people who are penciling this team in as some sort of upset patsy need to watch them play more. They're just really, really good.
Yeah.
I think they're going to win this series. I would, again, bet on them splitting in New Orleans, come back, win the series. Next round, it's a heavyweight fight. Like, there's no way around it. Whoever it is, from then on out, it's a heavyweight fight. No shame in losing, but they are going to have a great chance to win that series. Like, this team is just really good. They have a legit superstar. And I think people are seeing now the Jalen Williams-Lou Dort tag team on defense is, it's going to become like their version of what Kawhi and Paul George were at their very best. Like, that's how good those guys are. And then they come off the bench with Cason Wallace and Aaron Wiggins. And God forbid they have three of those guys on the floor at the same time. You're just dead on arrival. You're not going to be able to score enough points. And the Chet Jonas thing is so interesting because it's very obvious when Jonas, like, puts Chet in the basket and hits a layup and is like, oh, he's too big, he's too strong, he's playing volleyball on the offensive glass. Oklahoma City's whole thing is like, you can have that stuff. We're going to try to minimize it the best we can, like you said. But, like, that stuff is two. We're going to get three because Jonas can't hang with Chet on the perimeter. And it's not just going to be Chet pick and pop threes. It's going to be, you're going to get so scrambled in rotation trying to figure out how to recover to Chet because Jonas can't do it. So you're going to send a guy from over here, a third guy, to do it. Jonas is going to have to go over here. While you're doing all that, we're going to cut. We're going to set flare screens. We're going to drive the ball. And we're going to get catch and shoot threes for anyone we want, or dunks and layups. And we're willing to live with Jonas making Chet look skinny a few times. And it would not surprise me if at the opening of game three, they finally put Valanciunas on Josh Giddey and put a wing on Chet Holmgren. I don't think they want to do that because I think they actually want Giddey to be on the floor for the Thunder and they don't want him played off the floor. But in the middle of game two, the Chet Jonas thing tilted so far toward Oklahoma City that I think that's been the obvious adjustment the whole time.
Yeah, and I kind of just want to piggyback off your point about their offense, because even if you defend all of that stuff properly, then they get the ball to Shea, and he's going to hit a big shot in the up against the shot clock. I mean, they had the perfect defensive possession last game, a play where Chet Holmgren falls down, he has the ball, it looks like a dead possession. I was like, wow, that's an amazing, great defense from New Orleans. And Chet finds a way to get it to Shea, and Shea just hits a mid-range jumper over a contest where I'm just like, yeah, that's kind of the great – at the end of the day, that's what they have, and that's exactly what New Orleans doesn't have. And I really wish Zion was healthy because it would have been fun to watch him go at these guys and the way that would have looked. Unfortunately, we weren't lucky enough to get that.
Well, and obviously that's a big deal for it's a superstar player. Yeah. It changes all the defensive matchups. Suddenly CJ McCollum's being guarded by Jalen Williams, who would have to guard Zion. And I think, you know, and they're going at CJ. I mean, Shea can get any matchup he wants. Just send a guard. Give me that guy. Give me that guy. They got into their guard screening toward the end of that, in the second half of that game, and got in a rhythm with that. But, you know, Brandon Ingram just can't get going in this series. And I've said this about Brandon a lot. I think Brandon is a very good player. And you look at his stats and it's like, wow, 20, 23, 6, and 6. And I've said this throughout his entire career. It doesn't feel like that when you watch him enough anyway. Like, it doesn't feel like he impacts winning as much as those numbers suggest he should. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. But I think we're seeing in this series, without Zion, they just don't have... CJ can do it a little bit. He's just facing such a size disadvantage. Right. They don't have anyone who can just get into the teeth of the defense and play make out of it consistently from the top and in. And Brandon Ingram just isn't that, has not been that guy. He wants to take mid-range jumpers. He's not a great passer. He's just an okay passer. He's a good passer at times, right. But he just has looked overwhelmed. And he's coming back from injury. He just came back from injury. Maybe that's all it is. But he just, without Zion, they just are struggling to really puncture the defense.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on it with Ingram, though. Like, it's not a good sign when we go, yeah, 23-6-6, and we didn't notice. Like, that's just not a good sign. Like, when if that's something that happens in those games where it's when you look at the box score, you're like, oh, I don't remember him even taking enough shots to get to 23 points, you know, or along those lines. Like, that's a problem. And that's the concern there with Ingram. And I like Ingram. I'm beginning more and more to just think, like, this might not be the right place for him. I don't know what's the right role for him in that regard. Because when he gets it going, it's really tough to stop. But it's so hard to get him going.
Well, and again, you would have loved to see them in this game with Zion,
right?
In this series with Zion, to see the full team under real, you know, and we know what Zion was doing when he got injured against the Lakers. He was tearing them apart. But I mentioned it after game one, like, Trey Murphy is going to have to start next year, and he just has to. He's starting now because Zion's hurt, but he's been a bench player when everyone's healthy. That's not tenable anymore. He's going to have to start. I mean, B.I., I'm looking at the box score now, is 18-4-3. Just didn't – Herb Jones made some shots, whatever. Whatever you have to do to realign your team so Trey Murphy's in the starting five next year is going to happen, and maybe this series will have some impact on that. I don't really know what else New Orleans can do in this series. It's not like they're loaded with easy adjustments to make or other ways to run their offense without Zion. Make more threes. I don't know. I mean,
they're
not built to do that.
They're not built for that. They're at a disadvantage defensively. Like, they're just not in a position where you feel like, you know, this is one of those things where you just look at it when you're going into the coaches' meetings going like, no idea. Like, I no answers at a certain point when you hit it a playoff series is you just have no answers. You've run out of them. And I think, unfortunately for this team, I mean, Nance goes down with an injury. It's you're at this point now. It's like, I don't know what we could do at this point.
Now, they almost won game one. They almost won game one. And they're going home. I think they'll win a game at home. Mo Dekeel, you wrote a piece for The Athletic today about big men spacing the floor, even though they can't, some of them can't shoot, quote unquote. And that was a wonderful piece for The Athletic. The Twitch stream, where can people find, again, it's not for me.
I got you.
Where can the under 40 set find the Twitch stream?
Easiest thing is follow me on Twitter, MODAKHIL_NBA. But the Twitch stream is twitch.tv/MODAKHIL_NBA. We're breaking down games, Zach. That's all we're doing. I put together an edit and we just run through it. And, you know,
and you're answering questions, right? You're like
answering questions live. If somebody has a question about a play or anything, we've had fun debates and gone lively with things like that. We're doing it almost daily. Just kind of depends on the schedule. On the weekends, I'm trying to do post game shows. So after four games, break down those, and those tend to be long shows, but we have a lot of fun. And I just love the hoops. So we're breaking down basketball at the end of the day.
Well, maybe you know, send me a link. Maybe I'll pop in and ask some questions under a pseudonym or something.
there we go.
Maybe I'll make my Twitch. You know, there's actually one time during the pandemic where I got on to the only time I was ever on Twitch was when all the NBA players in the bubble were playing Call of Duty. And I guess they were and Josh Hart. I was like listening to Josh Hart play Call of Duty, and I was like, "All right, this is I'm entertained by this for 15 minutes." Like, it's not Josh Hart's like talking trash, and I was playing with somebody else. I can't remember who else. Maybe I'll tune in. But well, if you want to know what happened in the game, what might happen in the next game, which is what the playoffs are all about, Mo's one of the guys who will get you there. Mo Dekeel, thank you for staying up late Pacific time after a 3-game Thursday. that ended badly for the Lakers, ended well for Joel Embiid, and then there was another game too. Mo Tequila, everybody. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.